Hey everybody, Mark Weiss Guy Weiss here. Thanks for watching and listening to some conversation I had with the Blog of Rock.
Hello, welcome to The Block of Rock, your hard rock and heavy metal podcast music magazine. My name is Uwe Lerch and I will take you backstage to the rock stars. Of course, we chat about the music that connects us all, about new records, about life plans and what used to be. But we also talk about the people behind it, what inspired and motivated them and what kind of rockstar tips do they have for you out there. In the show notes, that is a description of this episode that you are hearing about right now, you will find a central link for all usage that will also take you to my official Facebook group. I would be happy if we get to know each other there. Are you ready for the start? Well, then come with me. I don't know how you're doing in the current situation, without concerts and without drinks with your friends. My recipe for the Corona Blues is always traveling back in time to the 80s, when you felt young and crispy, your hair was long and your jeans were torn. When I hear this great music, I dive into a kind of meditation and immediately get better. I can well imagine that you feel the same way. Therefore, I invite you today to step into the time capsule with me, to meet a man who has captured this decade in pictures like no other. Mark Weiss, nicknamed the Weiss Guy. Not all of you know his name. Mark is a photographer. The photographer. Countless pictures go to his account that you immediately have in mind. The record cover of Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet, Twisted Sister's Stay Hungry, Cinderella's Night Songs, Last Command by Wasp, Under Lock and Key by Dokken, plus hundreds of front covers from magazines, tour books and posters. You know them all. A few weeks ago, his book The Decade That Rock was published in the US. Weighing about 3 kilos and almost 400 pages of memories from the good old 80s. He was really there when the 80s rocked. The book has recently been available to order in Europe via Amazon, and if you still have an empty wish list for Christmas, I'll have the links ready for you. But now get in and buckle up. In part 1 we talk about his beginnings as a photographer and the really big events of the 80s. The US Festival, Live Aid, the recordings of Ronnie James Dio project Here and 8 with all the big stars and the legendary Moscow Love and Peace Festival. So let's get rocked. Welcome to the Block of Rock, the show where we're going to do time travels back to the 80s. And I'm really, really proud and happy to introduce Mr. Mark Weiss today. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
People know you, of course, as the Weiss Guy, but most of the people haven't seen your face, but they know your photos because people will have lots of records in their archives with your photos on or inside. So maybe you give a short introduction, who you are, what you're doing.
Okay, it's Mark Weiss. I started when I was 12 mowing lawns, and a guy gave me his camera for mowing his lawn for the season, you know. So, you know, I knocked on his door and his lawn was really long and I said, do you need your lawn cut? And he said, no, I do it myself. And then he's like, he thought I was like a smart ass, and he came back with his camera. He said, I'll tell you what, kid, if you mow the lawn, I'll give you this for the season, you know, and I did. And the rest was history. From then on, I started going, you know, taking pictures of my dog and my brother riding his motorcycle. And then I went to concerts, stuck my camera in, and then it kind of just snowballed into shooting concerts, and that's where I got my love of taking photographs.
Was it difficult at that time to sneak in with the camera?
Well, yeah, I used to wear Fry boots. Fry boots are these big boots that you put on the, you know, they're huge, and I used to put a lens in there. I used to wear a hoodie with the camera strapped to the back, so when they, you know, pat you down, you can go through it, you know. So I did that, and then once I got in a good spot, I would, you know, put everything together, and start taking pictures, you know, just sneaking in as a 15, 16 year old kid.
And I've heard that there's a story that you got arrested after taking pictures.
Well, yeah, at a Kiss concert, 1977, I was sneaking in. I was selling my pictures at the time. So I would go in, like say Kiss would play the first night. I would take pictures, sneak in, and then blow them up for that night, maybe make 100 or two and sell them for a buck a piece. So this time after the concert, I was selling them, and I knew it was illegal, but you know, I was making a buck to buy a film for the next show. And so I ended up in the paddy wagon with all the shirt sellers. And the next day, you know, they said, if you want to come back and claim your photos, you'll have to, you know, go in front of the judge. I'm like, just keep them, I'll see you later. And then like the next day, I was like, what am I going to do now? And I just went to Circus Magazine, which was a big rock magazine, one of the biggest, you know, and I used to read it since I was 12, 13. And I just went there. There's an address in there. I had a subscription. So I looked at the address and I just went there with my portfolio, and the secretary took a liking to me and said, you know what? It's, you know, the art director is off deadline today. Why don't you wait a couple hours when he's off, and then I'll have you come in. So I waited like maybe 3-4 hours, waited patiently. And then they went and saw me. I showed them my photography and they liked what I did, but they wanted me to shoot with flash and with a different film and a couple things that magazine required. So they said, all right, well, come back when you think you have something. And that summer, 1978, I shot Aerosmith, Ted Nugent, and I think Journey was a Mahogany Rush. And I had some really, really good photos of Aerosmith. They weren't letting too many photographers shoot them because they were like in the dark days, and you know, they didn't want it, you know, they were not giving out photo passes. So I had my camera snuck in, sent them the pictures. And then 2 months later, I went to the newsstand and I saw in the magazine, it was the biggest picture in the magazine. It was the centerfold of Steven Tyler. And that's where the ball started rolling, you know?
And did you realize that this could be your future business, not only a hobby?
I don't know. It was just fun. When I was 12, I had a motorcycle accident, to go back a little bit, and it hit my head. I got a concussion and I lost my memory from then on. And then after that, I really could remember things. And so I never did good in school, but photography was just like, you click a button, you know, that's it. To me, that's all it was. It was very easy. You just pick it up, look through it. Oh, that looks good. Click. So that's when I knew I had to just keep going with it, because I felt it gave me confidence, you know what I mean? So, you know, okay. It gave me confidence to, you know, and then I started standing out, like all the, you know, the girls and the cool guys in the school, I started getting attention from, because I had these pictures. I used to sell them out of my locker. And, I kind of knew, like, what else am I going to do? You know, so... But I still went to college to keep my parents happy. I still went through the motions. As I was working for Circus Magazine, I was still going to college, you know, to keep the parents happy. And it just didn't work out. And then I'm making a living already, you know, doing photographing. I started working for Circus and making money with other magazines. So after the first year of college, I kind of said, that's it. You know, I didn't even tell my parents I left college after the first semester. It wasn't for me. I showed them my first picture in Circus, the centerfold. And I said, you know, I want to tell you something. I want to tell you two things. First thing, I dropped out of college. And, you know, and the second thing is I'm working for Circus Magazine. And I showed them the picture, you know, so.
How did they react?
They were very supportive, you know. My father didn't go to college, so he wants his son to go to college. You know, my father was an aluminum siding salesman, and you know, he turned himself into his own business and was very successful. But he was a salesman. So, and my mother was in public relations, and so I kind of got a little bit of both of them in me. You know, my father's salesmanship and my mother's press, you know, instinct.
So let's test your memory and let's go back to the 80s. Let's do a little time travel. And I think the 80s is the decade that rocked most. And finally, you just are about to release the book under the same name. So did you collect all the pictures to make this beautiful book? I had a look already into it.
I mean, At first, I signed the contract with my publisher 7 years ago. And it was just going to be a simple book. It was just so overwhelming to just do a book the way it ended up. So I wanted something simple. So I said, why don't we just do photos of the hair bands? It'd be easy. You know, just take a photo of, you know, every band, you know, or person that had at their highest. And, you know, I started doing it, and then I started thinking to myself, you know, I don't want that to be my first book. You know, that doesn't say who I am. And so after 2 years of working on that, not really feeling it, I just decided to change course and wanted to do a narrative book, you know, about me, how I became a photographer, and, you know, turning it into a career and a lifestyle, and, you know, how it, you know, you know, so the book starts out when I was 12, you know, when I got my camera, and I talk about it. And then, I have some pictures of like Peter Frampton, Led Zeppelin, some early Aerosmith, 76, you know, well, you know, up until, I think 79, I shot Sammy Hagar in there too. I put that in there, you know, anything rock related. I mean, I shot a lot of other kind of stuff too, but I really wanted to lend itself to where I felt 80s rock kind of evolved from. And I felt like evolved from those bands that I picked for the book. And then, 1979, I shot Judas Priest for the first time. And I kind of end that chapter, the early years, with that. And it's a shot of Rob and KK. It's like an amazing photo. I'm really proud of that one. And then it goes into the 1980, you know, AC/DC, you know, they had a party at Privates, a small club in New York City. David Coverdale came and Brian Johnson was there, and they had balloons that said AC/DC. So I start the chapter of 1980 with that, with those two photographs. And then, and it just kind of evolves, like, you know, so I had to do it very systematically. Like, 'cause when I decided that's what I wanted to do it, I dealt with each year at a time. I couldn't just think of the whole thing. It would have been just mind blowing, you know? So I took every year really seriously, I overdid it. You know, I overdid it so much that this 278 page book, which ended up being 400 pages, I designed it to be 600 pages, but I had to do it. That was the process, you know, and a lot of the photographs in each chapter, you know, I had to really decide who's going to go in and when and where and who I'm going to leave out. So it really came down to shoots that really meant a lot to me, and also to the artists, and also to the fans.
What do you think, what made the 80s so memorable, a part of all the other decades you lived in? Because, you know, you picked this special decade. It's the same for me, because it was the decade of my later youth. When I was 15, the 80s started, for you a bit later. But what made the 80s so special?
Well, the 70s were kind of my special to me, because it's where I kind of learned everything. You know, it's where I knew I loved Led Zeppelin. I knew I loved Kiss. I knew I loved Aerosmith, Ted Nugent. You know, I knew I loved all these bands. And then when the 80s came, in New Jersey, I started photographing this one band called White Tiger. And White Tiger and Twisted Sister were the big club bands in the area. And you only had to be 18 to get in the clubs, you know. So I was 18 and I can get into the clubs, and, you know, it was a whole scene, you know. They would, you know, Twisted would play mostly their originals, but they have covers too. But White Tiger was just all covers, and they played Led Zeppelin and AC/DC, you know, anything that was going on, Judas Priest. And they started dressing that way. And then the girls started flocking in, and it was a way to, you know, find, you know, company for the night. You know, you go to the rock show and you end up with a girl. So, and then there's me with the camera in the front, you know, looking around, seeing everybody. So it was just, it's where, you know, I ended up. And the 80s, that was just the beginning of everything. It's like, it feels like all those bands from the 80s, you know, they took all the bands from the 70s, like Sweet and Bowie and T-Rex and, you know, all Led Zeppelin, and they kind of like mixed it up together, and they turned it into the super rock star, like what the dictionary would have meant, you know. And then MTV came around, and it's like image was so important, you know, just as much as the music. And I think all these, and I heard them talking about it, you know, when we've been doing these interviews, they would take all these, you know, rock stars from the 70s and like emulate them and go a little further with it, you know, and fine tune it, you know, so their costumes were more defined, you know, where in the 70s, I'm sure they just had, you know, a friend do it. And then, you know, but now it was a business, like rock and roll fashion was a total business. And I just got I was part of the equation. You know, you do a photo shoot with me, I get into magazines, I do the album cover, you do a video with Wayne Isham or Marty Kollner. And, you know, it was a certain formula. So I was in the very beginning of the 80s, I became part of that, you know, the visual imagery that became, you know, to me, the decade that rocked, you know, it's, you know, I think it's, you know, I love the title. I love the name, and I'm branding the name now. I created a Facebook dedicated to inspired by the decade that rocked, by my book, The Decade That Rocked, and my photography, The Decade That Rocked. So on those Instagrams, at The Decade That Rocked, and my Facebook, it is about me and as photography and my photography, but I'll put album covers that aren't mine. I'll put, you know, I'll put anniversaries and birthdays and little things and this and that. So it's, you know, pretty much me, but as opposed to having, and I have Instagram, Mark Weiss Photography, and Instagram and Facebook too, but I wanted to appeal to a younger audience because the demographics now, it's funny, I checked my views on my interviews, and it seems like they're from 25 to 35 and then 55 to 65.
Okay.
It's like the 35, I don't know. So that's what, you know, when I look at the, you know, the graph, it's interesting. And I think it's because of the Dirt and all the rock and roll.
Yeah, of course. So it's the kids of the original fans.
Yeah.
So let's dive into the book, because you mentioned already a couple of artists, and luckily I grew up in a city called Dortmund, which was more in the center of Western Germany at that time. And we had an arena where most of these 70s and early 80s rock stars played. And I was lucky to at least see them live, including like Zeppelin and AC/DC with Bon Scott, and of course with Brian then later on. But you've witnessed some events in rock history, which I'm really, really jealous of. And I would like to talk just a couple of minutes about these events, about your rememberings and memories about this. And I want to start with the US Festival, where I recall that was one of the biggest festivals ever happened in San Bernardino in the Valley, which was somehow organized by Steve Wozniak, the Apple founder. Am I right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was the second one. I believe it was the second one. I think the year before they had more pop artists.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
I think this is the first year that they had heavy metal artists. And yeah, it was, you know, when Motley Crue, I went there with Ozzy, you know, anytime Ozzy would play somewhere, they'd want me to go. And they would get me a backstage pass, pretty much pretty easy, you know. At that point, I already developed my relationship with Ozzy. And I was like his photographer. So you're walking around and there's Motley Crue walking to the stage with a bottle of, you know, Jack in their hands. And I just, you know, whip my camera around and start shooting, following them in. I shot them the year before for We Magazine. So they knew me. I haven't seen them since. So all of a sudden, hey, Weiss guy, how's it going? You know, so, you know, it's like all of a sudden there's that. And then there's Judas Priest over on the other side walking around. So everyone's like, you know, walking around and going to stage. But when Motley Crue hit the stage, you know, I mean, no one even knew who they were. You know, they were a club band pretty much, you know. You know, in California, they were starting to get known, but, you know, not to those 300,000 plus people. So when they started doing, I think it was Shout at the Devil, I don't think they ever even played it live, and no one even knew it, but people were chanting it, like, you know,
really?
And it's like, it was like one of their moments, you know. And, you know, I captured, you know, here's a little bit from the US Festival right here in the book. show you. So there's Tommy looking at the 300,000. Yeah. And there we go.
Oh, great. And I think in the Dirt movie and in the Dirt book, they describe this scenery also from their perspective. Oh, festival as well.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It was a moment in Motley history for sure.
Crazy.
And then Quiet Riot, you know, like I think 3 months later, they were number one on the Billboard charts, you know, which was a game changer for everybody and all the record companies. And that's when everyone started getting signed, you know.
So maybe this festival, this specific event really broke heavy metal in the US as a, for a certain point, because it made all these bands so big.
Yeah, I mean, Ozzy was already big. I mean, all the bands were pretty, the only ones that weren't big really were Quiet Riot and Motley Crue. And those are the two bands that broke out. So those were new bands. And because there were new bands, record companies like, we got to find some more of these new bands. And then, you know, and they started signing with all these other bands that were had the formula.
I spoke with Rudolf Schenker about the US Festival a couple of years ago, and he told me the story when they entered the stage that the Starfighters flew over them, the airplanes.
Oh, yeah, yes, yeah.
And he didn't know, still didn't know how they organized it, that it was exactly in that moment when Scorpions entered the stage.
Mm-hmm, yeah, crazy.
By the way, almost the same lineup which you had at the US Festival came half a year later to an indoor festival in the arena where I obviously grew up. It was Ozzy, Leopard, Scorpions, Maiden, Schenker, Crocus, Quiet Riot. And this really broke heavy metal in Germany. So this was the US Festival. But later on, you saw some other events which were really remarkable. And I recall you went to Live Aid in the US.
Yeah, that was another one that, you know, I found out Black Sabbath was going to reunite there, you know, and I called, you know, Sharon and Ozzy, and they said, yep, come on down, you know, and that was another thing that was really amazing, because here's Black Sabbath in the middle of, like, Madonna and, you know, the Rolling Stones with Tina Turner, you know, so that was a trip, and I remember I was backstage, and Jack Nicholson was one of the hosts, announced one of the bands, and he was, there was a sign on his door, it said Jack Nicholson, and I was like, oh my God, that's so cool, you know, and then he popped his head out, you know, he started walking out, so it was right next to the Black Sabbath dressing room, so I went over to him, and I said, hey, I'm Black Sabbath's photographer, my name's Mark, you know, you mind if I take a picture, and he's like, yeah, sure, kid. And he took a cigarette and he put it in his mouth, and, you know, and I got a nice portrait of him with it, you know. So that's not in the book, but it was in the book originally, but I had to pull it, you know.
Typical Jack Nicholson pose.
It was good. He had the sunglasses, and yeah, kid, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, take it. You know, because you have to, some people, they don't ask, you know, and they just take it, and then it ends up being like a paparazzi shot.
Yeah, that's right.
You have to give them respect too. I mean, you know, he could have said no, but he was, you know, he was in a good mood. I mean, everyone, you know, those kind of events, everyone is like, you know, they're there for a reason. It's there for the good of, you know, what the foundation was for. So it's kind of hard to say no.
Another event, which was not so popular, but for the metal history, one of the, I think the biggest recording was the Hearing Aid thing with the Stars, with Ronnie.
Yeah.
So how did you manage to go there?
Well, I mean, I developed a relationship with Ronnie when he was in Black Sabbath in 1980 when that first came out, and I was started becoming their photographer as well. And then, you know, I just stuck with him with whatever he did, and I was, you know, friendly with them, with Ronnie and with Wendy, and I would do the publicity photographs when they needed band photos and new photos. So, of course, when this happened, you know, Wendy gave me a call and said, you know, I have something special that you need to come out to LA for. So, you know, she didn't really have to say much, you know, and when I went there and all my buddies were there, it was, you know, it's amazing, you know, and that one photograph with everybody, you know, and it was an honor to be there. And then they even let me take photographs in the recording studio, you know, so I have shots of, you know, Rob Halford sing, doing his vocal line, and Don Dokken and Jeff Tate from Queensryche, which ended up being a spread, like these photographs, like that spread started out being like 6 pages, and I had to just, you know, turn it into, actually, I had to fight for 2 extra. They wanted it to be 2 pages, and I ended up getting 4 out of it. So, you know, me and the, we went back and forth until, you know, everything made sense.
I had the luck to interview Ronnie a couple of years later, and he signed me the original single, a 12-inch. And, wow. You know, it was at a festival in Germany where I did an interview with him, and sadly, short after he passed away, and I said to myself, I want to have all the signatures of all the living artists, and I would say I'm at 80% already. And it was, of course, was great to meet all the guys and to have a talk. I talked with Vince Neil about this situation also, whom I met also later on at Wacken, and mm-hmm. he got signed here as well. But this is a very remarkable thing. Can you show us some pictures from the session? Do you have it handy?
Yeah.
By the way, guys, the book is for sale. I'll tell you later.
Okay, yeah. Well, here's that photo I was telling you about. Here's a couple of things.
Oh, great. Yeah. Wow.
No one's ever seen them. That's like...
Yeah, yeah.
Had to dust off the negative.
Amazing. Amazing.
Here's the photos of them recording.
Yeah, I remember the scene from the video where everybody individual is singing in the studio and yes, everybody doing this line, one or two sentences. Yeah, yeah, that's great. Yeah. And the last event, which was more or less at the end of St. Century, was also something very special, was the Moscow Love and Peace Festival.
Right.
Because this was something really new, that because there wasn't something anything before in the Eastern Bloc, I recall. Because at that time there was, you know, the world was divided into two parts, and heavy metal was, I think it was big in the in Russia, but not really promoted there. And it was Doc McGee who made it happen. And you were there as well.
Yeah, I actually went there the year before with John and Doc and the band in the wintertime. And we met
I saw the pictures. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
We met all the dignitaries, and that was a trip because we were treated like royalty, you know, and I was there documenting. We actually went into the stadium where the concert ended up being, but it was just snow all around, everyone's wearing the coat. So it was kind of fun to, you know, go there like that. That's how Russia's known for it, this cold weather. Yeah, right. And you know, so and then we went in the summer, of course, and it was, you know, beautiful, and, you know, it was very nice, you know, so.
And you all the U.S. artists came with the same plane?
Yes, yeah. I believe we started in America. I think we stopped in England to pick up the Scorpions. I think that's what we did. I don't really remember, but we were all on it eventually, and we all we're having fun on the plane, you know. It was supposed to be like no drinking or anything, but there was drinking. And at the end of the trip, I mean, there was, you know, John Bon Jovi was playing with Richie and Tom Kiefer and Jason, all singing around, you know, with acoustic and, you know, jamming in the middle, you know, midair. And, you know, there'd be, you know, Sebastian would be lying on the floor underneath the seats, you know, passed out. You know, you know, I remember, like, you know, the stewardess, like, walking over his leg, you know. So it was fun.
That's just really crazy. Really
and
crazy.
Then when we arrived, you know, everyone's starting to go off. I said, wait, hold on. You know, let me go down there and set, you know, get set it up. You know, so all, me and some other photographers ended up on the bottom of the you know, where they exit the plane and they kind of walk down. And I really got one image that was real special to me. It's kind of says it all for things that were to happen. I think Ozzy was in the front scratching his head. And then there was Vince and there was John and Richie with the peace thing. So you have to look at the photo, but there's a lot after, because a lot of shenanigans went on and a lot of things happened between like Motley and Bon Jovi, that's everyone's aware of, you know, so they had some friction going on because of the pyro and things and Doc, you know, being, you know, fighting, there's some fights and all that. So I'm just glad to capture that moment. And then after that, I had everyone go up on an area where they were all like lined up in a row. And I just, you know, got them. Peter Max, actually, who's a famous artist, did the artwork on the plane and also the official posters. So I put him in the middle and he gave the classic peace sign. And that was so that's in the book too.
If you enjoyed this episode, please follow me at the podcast dealer you trust so that you don't miss the next one. You will get the entire season as a free subscription service from Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Deezer, SoundCloud, YouTube, the Google Podcast Portal, and, of course, via my homepage, theblockofrock.com. You can also listen to the stories that have been already published there, because there's new food in here every week. And above all, tell your friends and share the good news on social media. All right? Then let's hear again next time. Until then, keep on rocking.